It's The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina Vega. FEC, you later. What does a top resignation at the Election Commission mean as we head towards 2020? We speak with the chair of the agency. Also on the show, fires in the Amazon have prompted an international outcry, but Brazil's president remains defiant.
Jair Bolsonaro, who was elected last year, campaigned on a promise to loosen environmental regulations and make it easier for people to go into protected land.
And on Spotify, albums keep popping up that look like surprise releases from major artists, but are actually being illegally uploaded to make a quick buck.
You know, users can see songs that have never been officially released climbing the charts on these streaming platforms because they've been put on there by individuals, just fans.
Accept no imitations. The Takeaway starts right now. And we're going to start with a story that could have major implications for the 2020 election. On Monday, Vice Chairman of the Federal Election Commission, Matthew Peterson, announced his resignation. You might remember seeing Peterson in the news a couple years ago, struggling to answer basic legal questions for a federal judicial nomination that he ultimately did not get.
Have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Criminal?
No.
Bench?
No.
State or federal court?
I have not.
But Peterson's departure from the FEC is a big deal. Why? Because it leaves the already short staff panel now one vote short of the minimum number of commissioners required to make decisions about the nation's campaign finance laws. In other words, the FEC is effectively shut down, something that hasn't happened in more than 10 years. And this comes at a time when there are growing concerns about the integrity and infrastructure of our elections. So let's talk about it. To help us unpack the ongoing turmoil, we're joined by the Democratic chair of the Federal Election Commission, Ellen Weintraub. Chair Weintraub, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So how is this vacancy going to affect your work at the FEC?
Well, first of all, I want to clarify something. We are not shutting down. The agency has a great staff of dedicated public servants who will continue to come to work every day and make sure that the agency fulfills its core mission of following the money and making sure that the American people are informed about who is supporting which candidates and how the candidates are spending their money. However, there obviously are severe implications for the agency's functioning when we don't have a quorum of commissioners to do the commission's business. So we will not be able to issue advisory opinions, issue new rules, or very significantly issue any decisions on enforcement matters. Any investigations that are currently ongoing will continue, but we won't be able to conclude them because the conclusion requires a decision by at least four commissioners. So we're going to get backed up pretty quickly on our enforcement docket. The good news is that the president and Congress can fix this problem, the Senate in particular. If the president nominates new commissioners and the Senate quickly confirms them, we can get back to business and with minimal interference in our mission.
So if you could give us a primer on the FEC, what exactly are the responsibilities of FEC members?
Well, the agency was set up after Watergate, as I said, with a core mission of disclosure, of making sure that the American people know who is supporting which candidates, who the candidates may be in debt to or might have conflicts of interest about. It's informative to the voters to know, well, if this group is supporting a particular candidate, then depending on how I feel about that group's issues, that might influence whether I want to support that candidate or not. So the committees, all of the political committees, candidates, party committees, outside spending groups have to file reports with the commission that detail how much money they are raising, who they are raising that money from, and how the money is being spent. We also have this important enforcement role. So there are rules on who you can take money from. Right now, one of the important rules that I'm very concerned about is the law against accepting any kind of foreign assistance in an election. We have seen in the 2016 election that the Russians in particular were interested in intervening in our election, and we need to have the cop on the beat to make sure that any complaints about that are very quickly addressed in the 2020 election.
Last time you were on The Takeaway, you talked to Amy Walter about the FEC's challenges in coming to a consensus, even when you did have enough members to work. Is the FEC fundamentally dysfunctional?
Well, we do have our challenges, and I want to say that it hasn't always been that way. When I first started on the commission, commissioners on both sides of the aisle shared the goal of making the commission work. And that meant compromise, and that meant reaching across the aisle, and that meant trying to find rules and guidance that four commissioners could agree on, even if no one might think that it was perfect. At least we could find a consensus, make some compromises, and get clear guidance out to the American public and the political actors who are obviously there in real time trying to make decisions about how to comply with the law. And we need to be clear about where the lines are and where the rules are. There has been, in the last 10 or 11 years, a real decline in that kind of collegiality and working across the aisles to find a four-vote consensus. And what I have seen from some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle is, since they are very skeptical of campaign finance regulation to begin with, they figured out that if they just vote together all the time and vote no, then they can block any action that they want to without trying to achieve consensus. It reflects the greater polarization in Washington in general. I don't think it is a positive trend. I don't think it well serves the American people. And I would hope that new commissioners who come on board would come on board with a real commitment to working together.
Now, two other spots on the commission have remained vacant for the last 2 years. What's been the holdup there?
Well, this is not something that anybody is consulting me about. And the nominations have to be made by the president, and they have to be confirmed by the Senate. I don't know why there have not been nominations to fill the 2-year vacancy on the Democratic side. There has been a nomination on the Republican side, although it's a little unclear which whether that was to fill the vacant seat or to fill Commissioner Peterson's seat. So why that those nominations haven't happened, why there haven't been hearings or confirmation in the Senate, I can't tell you that. That's not for me to decide. I can only urge the president and the Senate to take quick action now. Obviously, if we didn't have these two longstanding vacancies, we would not be in this bind today.
I've been speaking with FEC Chair Ellen Weintraub, and we're going to come back to her in a moment, but I want to bring in Chris Bing, a cybersecurity reporter at Reuters. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You reported on Monday that the U.S. government is increasingly concerned about how cyber attacks like ransomware could disrupt the 2020 election. How real is this threat?
That's right. I think it's quite real. What we've seen just over the last 2 years is that cities and counties have been victims of these ransomware-style attacks. And for those who aren't familiar with what this is a type of computer virus largely associated with criminals that will lock up a computer, make it inaccessible to the user, unless they send a cryptocurrency payment back to the hacker. Now, this can be very disruptive, though, because whoever owns that computer can't access it. And in the case of cities and counties, they may have very important services for their constituencies that they need to use those computers for, be it taxes or something else. The concern here, obviously, is with voter registration databases, which are critical in the election process.
So in these incidents involving states and municipalities, how often do they actually pay these ransoms to resolve the problem?
You know, there's not a lot of transparency in understanding how often they pay the ransom. The cases that are publicly known, those cities and counties worked pretty closely with law enforcement. And so the understanding is that they did not pay the ransoms, but rather they worked with individuals from the FBI and from the government to try and regain access. But while they were trying, obviously, they couldn't access those computers. So there was a backlog of work and all their systems were disrupted.
So looking forward to the 2020 election, what is the nature of the attacks that experts are worried about?
Ransomware is really something that is not theoretical. It's something that the government is already seeing spread across the country. And if this type of virus were used against voter registration databases and the election systems, it could have real impact. There's only one day that you can vote. or there's one major day that people are voting, I should say. And if you had a large cyber attack that were to disrupt those systems, it could cause people to not be able to vote, delays in voting. States are going to have to come up with a difficult decision of whether they should pay that ransom to regain access as quickly as possible. And at a large enough scale, it could really potentially compromise voting results.
And these attacks have brought cities like Baltimore and Atlanta to a stop. Are these threats mostly domestic? Are they foreign? Both?
That's a really good question. Ransomware has been popular, I'd say, really over the last 5 years. And although it's typically considered to be something that criminals do for financial gain, what we've seen over the last 2 years is foreign governments also use it, primarily Russia and North Korea, where they used ransomware as a means for another goal. So they used ransomware, for example, in Ukraine in an incident that's known as NotPetya to damage Ukrainian companies. And the virus would ask the victim to pay for regaining access, but in fact, it didn't regain access at all. It was just deleting the data underneath it. So we're coming into this election now with the understanding that foreign intelligence agencies view ransomware as a means of destruction and disruption against their victims.
Ellen, if you could weigh in now, I'm curious, what role does the Federal Election Commission play in countering attacks on our election infrastructure?
Well, not much of a role, frankly, not the kind of attacks that you're talking about. The elections are administered at the state and local level, so it is going to be on state and local officials to make sure that they are protected against cyber attacks. And I know that the Department of Homeland Security has been working with state and local governments on this. There are also bills in Congress to provide greater resources to state and local officials in this important job. They are those bills are tied up in Congress right now and can't get a vote in the Senate in particular. So I would urge all members of Congress, this ought to be an area of bipartisan concern and bipartisan consensus. I would urge Congress to adopt both the bills that would provide these greater resources and cybersecurity tools to the folks on the ground who are going to be working with these databases and trying to protect them, as well as adopting greater there are also bills to provide strong sanctions against any foreign actor who would seek to employ any kind of cybersecurity weapons against the United States and its democracy. And I think that we really need to take a stronger stand and ensure that foreign actors who would seek to do us harm know that there will be serious consequences. So, as I said, there are bipartisan bills in Congress, and I urge Congress to adopt them quickly and the president to sign them.
Ellen Weintraub is chair of the Federal Election Commission, and Chris Bing is a cybersecurity reporter at Reuters. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the past few weeks, fires in the Amazon have been burning at a rate not seen in years. Brazil's Space Research Center reported a 77% increase in fires this year compared to 2018. And climate scientists worry that large parts of this rainforest, which is critical to capturing carbon dioxide, will not be recoverable. The president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, has long been an ally of industries that want to use farm, mine, and log land in the Amazon rainforest. And he has supported rolling back environmental regulations for the Amazon. And while international leaders are calling on Bolsonaro to address the crisis, so far the Brazilian president has remained defiant. For more on this, I'm joined by Ernesto Londoño, the New York Times' Brazil bureau chief. Welcome back to The Takeaway.
Happy to be with you.
Can you put the magnitude of these fires into context? Have we seen fires of this scale in the Amazon before?
We actually have, but not in quite some time. The tens of thousands of fires that have been burning so far this month mark at least a 10-year high. So people here in Brazil and out in the world are understandably concerned about the implications of these fires. However, I think it's important to note that it's part of a cycle that happens in Brazil every year as farmers prepare land for crops and for cattle grazing. What's different is that this debate is unfolding at a time when much of the world is really worried about climate change. And now the spotlight is on Brazil
So let's talk a little more about the contributors. You mentioned cattle grazing and crops. To what extent are these being ramped up under the current government?
President Jair Bolsonaro, who was elected last year, campaigned on a promise to loosen environmental regulations and make it easier for people to go into protected lands. He felt that environmentalists had sort of won the debate some decades ago and that it was time to tip the scales. And since he's been in office, we've seen him press that issue very, very assertively. And what that looks like on the ground is, I think many people, if they go out and take land, even illegally, what they're doing is creating facts on the ground and that the laws will eventually catch up with what they're doing.
So how much would you say the international attention to these fires has actually prompted the government to act?
I don't think Brazil has seen a reckoning this fierce over its environmental policies in many years. However, it's a debate that many in the country, including the president, doesn't seem eager to have. Brazil historically has been very, very protective of its sovereignty and has resented efforts in the past to sort of put the Amazon on trial as something that, should be negotiated and whose fate should be decided as though it were a piece of world heritage.
Now, members of the G7 have pledged their support in the form of $20 million to help fight these fires. But President Bolsonaro has so far rejected the money. Why?
I think it boils down to the way French President Emmanuel Macron build this. I think when he sounded the alarm in terms that Brazil found unreasonably stark and menacing last week, it put the Brazilians in a defensive crouch. You know, however, I think there is a recognition that more resources are needed, that the environmental agencies in Brazil have been weakened and are kind of running on fumes in much of the country. So in some parts of the government, there's a recognition that additional resources would be very welcome. However, what we don't have is a consensus about, you know, whether the country, in fact, is ready to start sending people out in the Amazon, about whether what they're doing, you know, is going to be backed by the most powerful leader in the country.
Ernesto, a report in CNN notes that the fires have subsided in recent days and are now back to relatively normal levels for this time of the year. Can you see this issue receding from the world stage anytime soon?
I think it depends. I think we still need clarity on the scope of the fires. We have the number of fires that have been identified from space, but we don't yet have a clear understanding of how extensive they were. I think the story will shift, you know, what happens politically. There's been a mobilization, particularly in the left, to get the government to make some firm commitments on the environment. There's been something of a mutiny among public servants who work for the environmental agencies. They've put forward a very interesting, compelling letter essentially saying that they are demoralized, outnumbered, and outgunned. We're going to have to see whether politically the needle shifts or whether attention from the world recedes. It's also important to note that the fire season is just getting started. And I think as long as many fires are burning, it's going to be hard for the politicians to shift attention elsewhere.
Now, you've said that the environmental protection laws that existed for decades really took shape, I guess, in a different era. Can you tell me a little about those protections?
Sure. It's important to be mindful of the history. Brazil started making a big effort to develop and populate the Amazon states back in the 70s during the era of military dictatorship. The government encouraged people to move to the Amazon and it built a road that cut through the rainforest. That planted the seeds for an era of runaway deforestation where this area, this vast area, essentially became kind of the law of the jungle with people going in and making a buck any way they saw fit without any real rules of the game. When Brazil enters a democratic era in the 80s, its constitution puts a very strong emphasis on environmental protections and creates a system to set aside very large parts of the country as indigenous territories and environmental reserves. But over the years, you know, sometimes the government has enforced those laws with greater enthusiasm than others. And over the past few years, when the economy has been sputtering, the emphasis has been to, you know, allow people to go into these areas and make some money, and protecting the environment has sort of taken a back seat.
Now, regardless of where one stands politically on issues like mining or farming, fires are not something that we normally would think of as politically popular, regardless of who you are. What is Bolsonaro's political base, his supporters, what do they want him to do about these fires?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think some of the people living in the Amazon have told us, you know, this is routine. This is just kind of part of the cycle of preparing the land for harvest or for cattle grazing. You know, this is not the kind of wildfires that are sort of engulfing, you know, inhabited areas and destroying property. So, you know, some people think this worldwide outrage is kind of crazy for people who don't understand that, you know, those of us living here have families to support. We need to put food on the table. And, you know, this is the way it works. If we're going to produce meat and export meat, if we're going to, you know, export soy, this is the way it's done. However, on the other hand, I think a lot of Brazilians have become deeply concerned that, you know, that within a few generations, the Amazon, which is precious and unique and irreplaceable, may cease to exist.
How about indigenous communities? Are you seeing a vocal outcry from indigenous communities who populate the Amazon?
Absolutely. I think indigenous leaders see an existential threat in President Bolsonaro. He has compared those of them that live in remote areas to animals living in a zoo, and has essentially said that they need to be wooed out of the forest and inserted into mainstream capitalist society. You know, in many of these cases, we're talking about indigenous communities that have very few people left. You know, some have no more than 200 people left in their communities. The warnings we hear from them are that they feel that this amounts to a slow rolling genocide.
Ernesto Londoño is the Brazil bureau chief for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Late last year, a pair of albums suddenly appeared on Spotify and Apple Music that looked like new collections of old and unreleased songs by Beyoncé. The albums were listed under the name Queen Carter, and given that B has a history of dropping surprise albums, fans at first thought this might be another case of an unannounced record release. But hours later, the albums disappeared, because they weren't real albums. They were leaked tracks that had been illegally uploaded to the streaming services, not surprise releases by the actual Beyoncé. Other big-name musicians like Rihanna and SZA have also been victim to this, and many more have seen fake or leaked tracks uploaded to their official pages. While bootleg music existed long before the internet, streaming services are struggling with the fact that some posters are gaming their platforms to make tens of thousands of dollars off of stolen music. Pitchfork staff writer Noah Yu has been following how streaming services are grappling with this issue. He joins us now. Welcome to The Takeaway, Noah.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, let's start with the basics. How do people get these leaked songs onto services like Spotify or Apple Music in the first place?
So the streaming services rely on distribution companies of various sizes in order to, you know, source their content, so to speak. And so all music has to be uploaded onto the platforms from distribution companies. There is no streaming service where you can just directly upload. At least, I should say, no music streaming service. On platforms such as SoundCloud and YouTube, users can directly upload, but kind of more quote-unquote legitimate services do require a distribution company. And so users are able to use those companies to kind of sneak on tracks that they have no, you know, legal authority to, you know, upload and distribute.
So these companies are sort of the middlemen, if you will, and they're, I guess, in charge of or not in charge of vetting these people who are uploading music.
Right, exactly. And how much responsibility lies on the streaming services versus the distributors is kind of a point of contention in the industry. And because there are so many different kinds of distribution companies with very different barriers of entry, it's kind of difficult to parse out, you know, which types of content are quote-unquote trustworthy or not.
So do we know how often this is even happening?
No.
Okay, so there's no data on this.
Nothing that's publicly available. It is an issue that people in the music industry are aware of. And like the aforementioned Beyoncé and SZA leaks happened at the end of last year. And since then, the problem seems to have only kind of heightened. And I mean, listen, the prevalence of leaks and bootlegs and stuff like that, they've always been online, you know, since the internet really had the capacity for, you know, people to gain access to those files. But now they're being kind of circulated and monetized, possibly in a way that I don't think we've seen before, and it poses a very unique problem.
And this is the big difference, it seems to me, back in the sort of Wild West days of Napster. I guess this is like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, early 2000s.
There was sort of like a purity aspect to this, that like, oh, everybody can access music. Mm-hmm. This is a whole new world. But now people are really making money off this, aren't they?
Well, potentially. And that's the thing, because there are public instances of, you know, users can see songs that have never been officially released climbing the charts on these streaming platforms because they've been put on there by individuals, just fans, really. And a lot of those fans, you know, are not trying to make money. They're just trying to get the content on the platform so that other fans can enjoy it. It just so happens that in some instances, you know, you can rack up a lot of streams, and those streams translate to a lot of dollars.
And you understand the motivations to some extent because you've actually been in touch with some of these people who are doing this illegally.
Right, that's correct.
So tell me a little more about these conversations.
So in the report that we published on Pitchfork, I got in touch with an individual who claimed that they had made upwards of $60,000 in royalties from uploading kind of leaked and unofficially released music to, you know, platforms like Spotify and Apple Music. And they had the, you know, receipts and the transaction records and stuff that seemed to indicate that this was true. And our reporting seemed to back that up.
You were able to corroborate these pretty significant amounts of money from a so-called sort of like a faithful listener.
Right, a very faithful listener, you could say. And we got in touch with the streaming services because we wanted to, you know, really learn what the security protocols were and like what allows a distributor to be verified, for instance, as a, you know, a trusted distributor of content. Are there vetting standards that the streaming services hold these distributors to, or is it just sort of, we'll take your word for it? Because, I mean, Daniel Ek, CEO of Spotify, said in a recent earnings call that the platform gets 40,000, close to 40,000 new tracks every day.
Oh, wow.
And so it's impossible, obviously, for, you know, for all of those tracks to be verified by people. And even algorithmically, you know, there are only so many databases that you can cross-reference songs against. So it seems like there's a lot of stuff going on the streaming services, and it's just hard to police all of it.
With this person you were referring to who uploaded music and has made $60,000 so far, was that an actual sort of theft of unreleased music from the studio? How did this happen? Do you
even know? Much of that music is floating around and available to listen to on the internet. Okay. And it's available on other platforms. Like many of those songs that were uploaded to Spotify can be found even right now on places like YouTube and SoundCloud. The reason that it doesn't pose as much of an issue is because in the eyes of the industry and the general public, these platforms have always been seen as sort of still a Wild West of sorts, you know, and these streams aren't monetized, and so it's fine. People kind of reckon, why does it matter? Our artists are still getting visibility off of this. You know, the song can't be officially released because of sample clearance issues or other problems, but hey, it's already out there. And sometimes they're, yeah, sometimes they're leaked, the result of hacks. Sometimes they are sort of just kind of released by the artist outside of the purview of the label.
So how do users even find these songs on, say, Spotify? Like with the Beyoncé tracks, they were uploaded under the name Queen Carter. But how would I come across that if I'm searching for Beyoncé on Spotify?
By being a diehard fan. Okay. And by being in the corners of the internet where diehard fans gather, ultimately.
Is it possible that, if not Beyoncé, that other artists are actually benefiting from the notoriety that comes around these so-called, you know, fake tracks?
It is a double-edged sword for artists. It is good for an artist to be able to keep their fans, you know, pleased with music in between, you know, official releases, and for that music to be available on a platform as ubiquitous as Spotify is definitely a plus. But on the other end, it is legally complicated.
All right, so uploading music illegally strikes me as something that could put someone in serious legal jeopardy.
Right.
Where do things stand right now?
We reached out to distribution companies that were named by the individual that we got in touch with as the companies that they used to get the music onto the streaming services, DistroKid and TuneCore. And so we got in touch with them. We got in touch with Spotify and Apple Music, sort of the market leaders in music streaming in the United States. And we asked them for comment, and the responses were varied, but all very non-committal as far as taking responsibility or kind of a game plan forward.
Why do you think that is?
I think that the moment that anyone takes responsibility, it kind of further complicates the issue. And then there are a lot of like kind of infrastructural change has to happen in order for it to be avoided going forward. And I don't think anyone wants to pay for that right now. So the services are loath to take responsibility. And the distributors are also loath to take responsibility because they're saying, we did our due diligence. Some things can't be caught by algorithms. And so in the case of the Beyoncé and SZA instance, the brand manager for the distribution company that leaker used, Sounddrop, told us that they have a human team of quote-unquote content moderators and an algorithm kind of checking everything that goes up, and it still kind of wriggled its way past those defenses.
Noah Yu is a staff writer at Pitchfork. His latest story, How Artist Imposters and Fake Songs Sneak Onto Streaming Services, is up now on pitchfork.com. Thanks, Noah.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I'm Arun Vanagopal in today and tomorrow for Tanzina Vega. Thank you so much for listening. This is The Takeaway. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.